All right, well, I'd like to pay my respects to the Kulin Nation, their elders past and present, and also especially on this day, which is many mixed feelings for them. Now, I want to talk about the making of Melbourne, that is the European city of Melbourne, but also the making of the book. Now, why do I start the lecture with this ship? Marco Polo. Well, it was a clipper, and the clipper was the fastest ship of its day. It was the epitome of modernity in transport in the mid-19th century. It set records of 61 days from England to Australia. It gave a hair-raising ride to anyone who was on it, going down the Great Circle route in the lower latitudes where icebergs could be seen. And it was a hell of a ride for people. But it was the pride of the shipping companies, these clipper ships, and they stress that Melbourne is really associated with modernity, which I'll speak a bit more of. Certainly, we've got many transformations in Melbourne, and perhaps the first one was the occupation, the invasion, the settlement. It's up to you which word you wish to use. Of the area, and it was really, I think, a revolutionary one. If you look at that image there, that was drawn in 1839 of Collins Street, and you can see where the straight line and the grid had started to make an impact on an Aboriginal landscape, totally transformed. And so just the European way of drawing straight lines on maps, of creating housing, streets, and etc., was transforming the place. It was also a time in 1839, 37 and 39, a speculative boom in allotments in the city, in this new town of Melbourne. And it was partly driven by new notions of property, private property. It was a fairly new idea in England. The old rural world of 18th century England was one where land was often still held communally, but that was changing by the end of the late 18th century with all those enclosure acts and the high farming movement. So you get the imposition of private property onto the lands of Melbourne and its surrounds. And these were given over to pastoral occupation, perhaps the fastest occupation in colonisation history. The whole of central Victoria was covered in a matter of 5 or 4 years. And of course, Victoria was then hooked into a global trade in wool exports. The second revolution was really created by the discovery of gold. And you had what we might call a demographic revolution, where the population actually just exploded. Melbourne itself grew in that decade by 4 times and Victoria by 9 times. Just imagine if in 10 years' time, Melbourne was 16 million people. What a transformation we would have seen. So it was a revolutionary moment again for this young society in its European form, only 10 years old, that it was now in a gold revolution. And I mean, we just have to get the sense of the excitement of this place where most people had just arrived. And you get that old pastoral society overlaid very quickly, because no one has a memory of it. Most of the population don't, and let alone any memory of the Aboriginal occupation of the area for so long, for 30 or 40, 50,000 years. So you get this sort of exciting, multicultural, very diverse society in class terms imposing itself. So Melbourne really is born modern, and that's one of the most important things to remember about it. He was hooked into global trade. You can see that by all the shipping in the Yarra River. This is taken from the South Bank. And you can see that straight line on the maps very clearly just put out in that HODL grid. There's the first railway line, and of course railways were another sign of modernity. England was being traversed by the railway boom in the 1840s, and people were beginning to move around in new ways. And this was happening in Melbourne as well. And you, of course, have got the first real Princes Bridge straddling the Yarra there as well by 1855. So all the hallmarks of modernity are there. But just to go through that, just a bit more precisely, what do people think about when they talk about modernity? Well, one of them is, of course, modern is the modern epoch, meaning post-medieval world. That's how historians categorise it. But modernity has other ideas, for instance, of colonisation. And certainly Melbourne was the epitome of the British outreach into the world, and even being called after the sovereign of the empire. You've got modernity being connected with the age of great cities. And there was a man called Vaughan who wrote a book called The Age of Cities in the mid-19th century. And this was the most exciting thing, where the rural world of England was being transformed into urban living, and towns were growing up, often from nowhere, greenfield sites that were created because of manufacturing being placed near coal mines or near forests earlier on. So you get this age of cities, and Melbourne is, as you can see in that previous slide, a commercial city. It's got a staple, that is wool, and it's exporting it to the world. And so you can see in many pictures of early Melbourne, those warehouses lined up along the river, and those docks and platforms being built so ships can take things from the country into the world. There's also a very strong faith in progress. The idea of progress was a key idea in the 19th century, and of course it's encapsulated in the Darwinian revolution of the theory of evolution. And so the British world seems to encapsulate the idea of progress. Britain is imposing itself on the world. There's the white man Burden's theory of colonisation. We are uplifting the peoples, the indigenous peoples of the world, through education, through religion. Yet also modernity is connected to professionalisation. And here we have in Melbourne in 1853 the Registration Act, which sets out the provisions for births, deaths and marriages. And that really is the systematising of this population. This democratic revolution is going to be systematised by people being properly counted when they enter the world and when they leave it. And of course William Archer, who's on the ground level of that change, as the second in charge, becomes one of the great 19th century statisticians, categorising and professionalising the counting of population. You also get, with modernity, people connected with the idea of freedom, escaping the age of monarchy and going into new ways. And of course we have many settlers coming in the 1850 being imbued with Chartist ideas, the Chartist program in England of gaining democracy for all, in all males at least, in British society. And there was going to be payment of members, there was going to be annual parliaments to keep the bastards honest, etc. So there were those ideas which many get expressed in the Eureka uprisings. And probably individualism is one of the great things about modernity too. And there's an English historian called Turgeith Tholfsen who argues that one of the big movements in the mid-19th century was two streams coming together, evangelicalism and the idea of self-improvement. And both of these intellectual movements made a huge impact on British society. They created, as he says, a network of organisations across Britain. Friendly societies, self-improvement societies, mechanics institutes, all these things are asking people to make the right decisions in their life. And it was a very important idea, and it captured cross-class, because it was basically a middle-class bourgeois idea of individualism, but the upper echelons of the working class saw this as the way to get ahead, and they eschewed class politics and went for self-improvement. So it's a very powerful idea. And Geoffrey Searle, the great historian of the gold rushes, argues that there is a Victorian exceptionalism happening in the 1850s, that these are the most special group of migrants that ever came, at least in the 19th century, to Victoria. And he points to things like they were, the majority of them, self-funding their trip. Before that, immigration was supported by the British government because it was so hard to get people to come out here rather than go to the Americas. He said they're the most educated bunch to date in the 19th century, and the most religious. and they were imbued with self-improvement. They believed in thrift and hard work and sobriety, in the main, not all of them, but and not all the time, but they did. This was one of their key values. And you can see that they're creating a can-do society that becomes very important as an ethic in Melbourne, at least in the 19th century. Just think, in 1854, they create the University of Melbourne. Now, it's not the greatest university in the world, or maybe in Melbourne if you work at La Trobe, but it is a wonderful, great institution. 1854. The Age newspaper was also created in 1854. Still going, limping a little bit in the digital age, but one of the great newspapers of the world. And also the State Library was formed in 1854. And until the 1930s, it was one of the great libraries of the world because they bought everything. Until their budget got hit by the Depression, they bought whatever was being published in the English-speaking world. So these were wonderful things, and it just shows you the power of thinking of these people and their belief in themselves and the society they were creating. Now, Searle hasn't got it all his own way, because I think if you look at a procession that opened the bridge, the Princes Bridge, just before the gold rushes, at the act of separation from that horrible New South Wales, which I escaped half a lifetime ago, then in fact, that procession was formed of mechanics institutes, temperance societies, the Rachabites, the self-improving groups in Melbourne were already there in the 1840s, which Searle, I think, overlooks a little bit. But a fabulous article published in the Victorian Historical Magazine, I believe, Andrew. So it's a wonderful article called The Gold Generation. And there you see the epitome of the doctrine of self-improvement. This was the State Library of Victoria, a free library. Everyone could go in, of any class, of any cultural complexion, and read a book if they wanted to. And that didn't happen in the old world. It didn't happen in England. There were mainly subscription libraries. So that, you know, if you take away one image from this lecture, just think of that. It's not in the book, sadly, but because it's not a photograph, but I think it's a very important image. Now, the thing about Melbourne is it's born at the time of the camera, and that is so important to how the way we remember and understand this city. The first daguerreotype was in 1839, and then the wet plates process was brought in the early 1850s, and you can see there in that image there the sort of heroic age of the camera, where the man is under his cover and his assistant is waiting there with the wet plate ready to slide it in for the next image. And here, this one of William Woodbury, to me, is very heroic image too, of that man next to the instrument of power, the camera, the instrument of memory. And the lower one is some of the cameras that were quickly developed, Sutton's early 1861 cameras. I think Richard Lynn brought one of those to Melbourne for his photography. So how do we understand this new city? There are diverse ways, of course, of understanding a city. We can look at its history, you know, how long has it been there, like London goes back to the Roman occupation, of course. You've got its structures and functions, you know, how the city's built, how it operates. Its built forms and its styles and the things that it drew on from the old world to implant in the new, or its ethos, its spirit, its way of thinking. And Robert Park, one of the great sociologists of the early 20th century, got interested in urban history in the 1920s, and he said that a city is a state of mind, a culture. And I think that's a really interesting way of thinking about Melbourne, because Melbourne is driven, I think, by an image of itself in the 19th century particularly. Hopefully still is, that we still have a sense of who we are, but certainly in the 19th century it had that sense of self. And you can see that where it's coming from. The place is settled as a European place in 1835. It goes through an enormous land rush and then a gold rush, and by 1867, when your workplace is laid down, your wonderful town hall of Melbourne, Then there's a laying of the foundation stone by one of the Queen's own son herself. Victoria, the place is named after Victoria, sends one of her sons. He's a bit of a dissolute character, and he just rides through, drinks a lot while he's here, etc. But the locals love him, and they get him to lay the foundation stone of the town hall. And one of the newspaper reports says, 20 years earlier, this place was a trackless forest. Now, of course, that's all baloney, because Aboriginal people had their own pathways. But that was just ignored and erased by these self-confident settlers that they were bringing civilization to this part of the world for the first time. So you can see their sense of self and the doctrine of progress. 20 years, we're doing this. We've built this incredible, brash, precocious young city in 20 or 25 years. And so you can see this other image of Melbourne in 1866. It's starting to spread out. It's heading into the suburbs, and it's creating many of those allotments are built on and built in because of the huge impact of the gold rushes. Now, the city is driven along after that by a number of things, and I'll just point to four. One was the age structure of the place. Remember all those people that came in the gold rushes? Well, not all stayed. Some went back. Didn't want to stay in such a colonial place, but others did. And then they went through family formation, and of course we all know once people go into the world, that's when they start spending. They want to buy homes, they have to buy this and that to set themselves up. So there's a great boom again in the economy around the late 1870s because of all these young people of the Gold Rush immigrants coming into the economic mode as purchasers in their own right. Also, you've got an immigration boom again comes in the late 1870s through to the late 1880s. This is mostly coming again from the United Kingdom, but it's being driven by, again, the magnetic forces of the colonies that they have now at this stage some of the highest standard of living in the world, certainly better than England at the time, who was still adjusting to the Industrial Revolution. You get a massive growth in Melbourne too, as people tend to still be attracted to living in urban areas. And by the 1880s, Melbourne has got 40% of Victoria's population. That's just weird in world terms. Very few other places are like this. But Australia is, as you know, settled along the coast and still is. How many people in Victoria? I'm not quite sure. We've got over 4 million in this city now. By the 1920s, Melbourne had 50% of Victoria's population. So it was an inexorable movement to urbanise. And so Melbourne's got this energy amongst it. Also, you've got enormous overseas investment coming. And often the argument was that Australia rode on the sheep's back. You would know that, Andrew. But in fact, the Butlins, there were two economist brothers, showed that in fact most of the British investment were going into cities, into urban infrastructure, into railways, into tramways, into curb and guttering, because all the local councils were borrowing like crazy. And we sort of rest on that. We worry about accumulating debt when interest rates are so low. These people borrowed because they knew they had to get started. They didn't want to walk through the mud to get to the local shop. They wanted paving and they wanted a road and they were prepared to borrow money for it. So enormous amount of money is going into Melbourne. So this incredible spirit of optimism that ends up in a land boom. And of course, there's a technological change happening in the 1880s too. Melbourne ceases to be a walking city as railways push out into the suburbs, allowing people to live in the suburbs and sleep there, but to work in the city. And that leads to a huge expansion. And Melbourne is weird, again, because it's spread out and it's still spreading out as it was a single story city for and suburbs for so long. And there was new technology, horse trams gave way to cable trams. And then a representative of the Otis Lift Company holidayed in Melbourne. And he came here and he saw this city which was 2 and 3 stories high, and he went bling, and he said to people, if you buy our lifts, you can put 10 stories on this bit of land where you've got 3 stories. Now just imagine the sort of calculations going on in people's brains about that. And so there was a transformation of Melbourne with a new height limit, which went up until the 1950s to the staggering size, 131 feet. And you all know what that means, but a bit over 40 metres. And so it did transform Melbourne, plus all the communications. You can see those telegraph poles in that image. There were telephones coming in for the first time, and those magnificent magnetic pneumatic tubes that took messages around department stores were introduced then as well. Gas lighting comes to Melbourne. So you get this sort of technological change and enormous optimism. And at this time, have I gone backwards? No, I haven't. Sorry. So you're getting this suburban city emerging, the dormitory suburbs, and they were driven by middle class aspirations of home ownership, of the virtue of living a life of respectability in your own place, your wife at home preparing your slippers and pipe after the busy world of the urban life. And you're living in Rue en Herbe. You've got a garden that looks a little bit like the countryside. It's your own special place in the world. And you've got people selling land that are saying, this is the form of true independence, to be a homeowner. And of course, most immigrants came to Australia for land, although for most it was a pipe dream. They never went on the land, but they still would have had it in their tradition, their family ideas, that to own a piece of land was true independence, away from the bosses and old corruption of the old world. And so Melbourne gains a high ownership rate, one of the highest rates in the world. I think it was close to 60% at this time, driven by building societies who were pumping money into and willing to lend it to anyone who wanted to have this aspiration of home ownership. So you get this enormous expansion of Melbourne in the 1880s. And into that world comes a journalist in the last days of his occupation, George Sala. He visits in 1885, and he coined the term marvellous Melbourne. And it was both flattering and alliterative. And people embraced it quickly. And of course, he made himself very popular for saying it. And so it really stuck. And even historians today still talk about the importance of the notion of marvellous Melbourne and what it might think. So you can see the city is growing, and this is some of the city segments. You've got the west on this side, which is business and warehouses and those sorts of things. On the other end, on the right-hand side, you've got the eastern end of Collins Street. You've got the entertainment areas. You've got some professional suites, and you've got Parliament at the top. So it's looking like a great city. And some magnificent streetscapes are being built, which of course are featured in the book. You know, the Collins streetscape around the Rialto is just a magnificent piece, and of course most of it's been saved, fortunately. And you get those gems, the Coffee Palace, the Federal Palace, which wasn't saved. Was one of the great magnificent buildings of its day. People say it's true Australian architecture because it's got a bit of everything. Each level of the building is different. But that's us just grasping from the old world what we think looks good. And of course the truly elegant ENSA bank building, which still is with on the corner of Collins and Queen Street. And so you've got these gems of bourgeois culture being built in Melbourne at this time, and many are in the book. The government buildings, the cultural institutions, that by the way is Wilson's Hall before it burnt down up at Melbourne University. Educational bodies, and of course shopping, and there's the Queen Vic Market. So shops, banks, cultural institutions, this made up the public buildings of Melbourne. And even the suburbs got into it. Look at those amazing town halls. You drive around everywhere in inner Melbourne and they have the biggest piles of town halls that you ever see. Probably trying to rival your workplace, I think, Councillor Watts, in its magnificence. And so that tells you that this ethos was widely shared. They were willing to borrow an enormous amount of money to build those. And I guess the pride in the city is most seen in the exhibition movement. As you'll probably remember, the Crystal Palace was the first international exhibition in 1851 in London, and there's an image of it. It was a glass building which was later dismantled. But Melbourne had its own, and you'll have to buy the book to see it. I'm not going to show it to you. And we had our own in 1854, and we had another exhibition in 1861, and then they took it down and built a mint instead just down the road. And this was an international trend across the world, having exhibitions across Europe, North America, and other places, inspired, I think, by two things. First of all, the Enlightenment, and in particular, rational amusement, which was defined as helping people to understand the world by looking. So you went to see an exhibition at a museum or a panorama somewhere, or a diorama of the Siege of Mafeking, and people learnt by looking. And the power of education was bound up in these things, but also the power of nationalism. Cities and countries showing off what they'd produced, what they were doing, and comparing themselves to other countries that were also exhibiting at these exhibitions. And Melbourne built another one of its great buildings for a new exhibition in 1880 and almost went broke doing it. The cost overruns, as usual happens with these things, were enormous. But it was a wonderful building, which of course was our first building to get World Heritage status. We had landscapes, of course, that had it, but not a building. And we have it in Melbourne and not in Sydney. And of course, in 1888, Sydney did have one. It was a very impressive building, but it burnt down. And all the Melbourneites said, oh, gee, we're sorry it burnt down, just as you were going to celebrate 1888, the centenary of Australia's settlement. So we'll hold one for you. We'll hold an Australasian exhibition for you. And when they did, and they had a grand opening, they had concerts and artworks that went for months and months, and they were attended by enormous numbers of people. Something like Graham Davison, in his beautiful work on this, has estimated attendances were 180% of the population. That's like 6 million people today going to the exhibition building over some months to see concerts, artworks, etc. And it was, of course, Melbourne's pride. And it was expressing the Australian sense of itself, a new world vision. They actually had an ode written for 1888. I was going to bring it and sing it, but unfortunately I didn't. And for your sake, you're lucky. But it was all about we are better than the old world. We are better, and we're going to create a great society. Of course, Melbourne, we should remember that it's not all as this gloss and this puffery says. If you see in this image here, if you look over, this is the block, these people parading around the block. But if you look to the left-hand side, you'll see a boy without any shoes selling things. He's a street hawker. And one of the groups at the bottom of the society. So Melbourne had another side to it, a cultural otherness that was expressed in the boarding houses and the tenements and the street people, the larrikin culture of some. And this created anxiety in some people. The scary, the dangerous classes, etc. But other people said, look, this shows we're one of the great metropolises of the world. We have an underclass, like London and like other things. So they looked at it both ways. Essentially, Melbourne overall was seen to be a respectable place. And there was also the cultural otherness of Chinatown. And this lovely map here, done by Chris McConville many years ago, shows down here the original 1850s settlement of Chinatown. How Chinatown expanded is these darker areas by the 1920s, and then the very dark two rectangles, or sort of rectangles, is where Chinatown is today. So there was a cultural otherness to Melbourne apart from this British world. Also, there was a bit of a smell about Melbourne, and particularly people in Sydney said, well, it's marvellous Smellbourne. And what they were pointing to was sanitation. Melbourne had huge disease rates in the 1880s, typhoid, etc. And its sewerage disposal was just appalling. Sometimes the night carts didn't make it out to Royal Parade, where they were supposed to be spread around. They were just tipped into the Yarra in the middle of the night. Still goes on in the northern suburbs with people tipping stuff everywhere and not putting it where they should be. The Yarra became the city's gutter as all those fellmongeries and other noxious trades were sighted along there. And it was only the heroic creation of the Melbourne and Metropolitan Board of Works which actually cleaned up Melbourne and created a world standard, in fact, ahead of many in the world, in the Werribee sewerage farm and the pumping station that lifts it up and gets it out to Werribee on the other side of the Maribyrnong. So it was a great story, but Melbourne did have this smelly image in the 1880s. So you get this glorious expansion and boom going on, but it went beyond the ability for people to buy housing allotments. There was subdivision after subdivision in outlying suburbs. I once wrote a history of Coburg. In this period, most of it was cut up. The farms that were there were cut up into subdivisions, but they remained unsold. And in the 1920s, many of them were still covered in thistles. So you're getting this enormous collapse with the building boom that burst, a loss of confidence in urban life. And for instance, there are a lot of people advocating a back to the land movement. There were 80 village settlements out in parts of rural Victoria trying to get people back on the land. The Heidelberg School of Art turned its eye from urban and close-in things to more rural themes. So you get the growth of what Russell Ward, the great historian, called the Australian legend, where people saw that their true Australian values were inspired and created in the bush rather than in urban areas. Graham Davison has made a very effective counter to that argument, but it's still being debated by historians where the inspirations for where Australian values came from. But people at the time, many of them were saying, people like Henry Lawson and others, that it's the bush culture that is creating the new Australian culture. So Melbourne's collapse was disastrous. There were bank failures, there were losses, there were suicides. Even Alfred Deakin lost money. Careful Albert, Affable Albert, had invested, like many other people, in allotments in land. Bit familiar? And so Melbourne then went into a great period of stagnation and conservatism. Now, in the last few minutes, I just want to talk to the creation of the book, which was one of the great projects I think we're all been involved in. We're invited to create a book that paralleled Lost Brisbane, and our committee, and we're all named on the front of the book, decided that we would do it, although it was a hellishly short time span to do it. They wanted it out by Christmas, and as publishers always do, and there wasn't a lot of time. There was about less than 18 months. We did some initial planning. We talked about how we're going to do it. We're going to have themes. Are we going to use the theme of lost, what has been lost in Melbourne? And then we decided maybe the best way to go is through precincts, and that we'd look at it in terms of streets. And then we'd organise it as you would might walk along the street and see the new evolving city and the 1860 city and the 1880 city, etc. And at that stage too, another book came out called Lost Melbourne. We thought, oh damn, but then we thought, oh okay. And we decided on the title Remembering Melbourne, which I think is a more loving, generous, romantic title, and rather than Lost, which is all doom and gloom. So we wanted to do more than the Brisbane book. You always want to improve on the opposition and the models that you have. So I, for instance, said, look, we have to have a chapter on Aboriginal people, Aboriginal Melbourne. I've been teaching Indigenous history all my life. I've been writing it. We can't have a book which is just about this European city with no mention. So I wrote a chapter about that. We got Graham Davidson to write a chapter about the shaping of the city. What was used to build Melbourne? What were the inspirations in building Melbourne in terms of the ideas and the styles, the fashions that shaped Melbourne? And then we asked someone from the Melbourne Camera Club to write about the camera, because we thought, well, the whole book's about pictures, and yet we're not talking about how they were made. So to give someone a very layman's brief understanding of what picture taking was like over the years. And so that image is by William Barrack, which is our own collection, out on loan currently, and that's one of the images that the Camera Club supplied to us. We wanted to seek more depth, and look, frankly, between you and I, we didn't know we were going to make the deadline. So we thought, why not ask historical societies to help us? We're the umbrella body after all. And so we wrote letters out to them, and most of them replied very quickly and said, yes, we'd love to be involved. And there were great mutual benefits. We got to finish on time, but we got a much better book because Melbourne is also its suburbs, especially in the 19th century. There are people now up in the hills, I believe, that no come to Melbourne at all. Hope none of you are here today and prove me wrong. But in the 19th century, people were very connected to their city because it was close to them. And the mutual benefits for them was they got to be part of this project, and they had wonderful arguments about, well, what were their best 15 pictures to give us? Because that's what we said, give us 15 pictures, captions please, permissions to use it. And they had a lot of arguments in local societies. What are we going to do? What will we give them? So it was a fantastic project because of that. And so it became, as I said, more remembered Melbourne than lost, although the designer once said, that I asked him how many times the book demolished was, the word demolished was used in the book. And it's about 200 times. So enormous part, maybe 30% of the buildings you see in that book, you can't see anymore except in a photographic image. And Melbourne has had three phases, a wooden beginning, a stone and brick middle, and a glass current period. And it's mostly on the stone and brick part of Melbourne that we feature in the book because of their time constraints in the book. So people got to work, caption teams, our own caption team. We had an image team going through up to 55,000 images, finding out all the images we've got of, say, Spencer Street, and then, well, which ones do we need? Which ones can we fit in? And then we would storybook. We'd lay them out as a team, and we'd look at them, and we'd sort of discuss them. Yeah, we need that. Oh, we've got to have that building, but, you know, can we fit it in? And they were wonderful. So all the people that are mentioned on the front cover of the book were doing that sort of work here, and this was going on in all the suburbs. And then we went through the editing process, the design process with our designer who does History News and the Victorian Historical Journal. Copy editing mainly fell to Judith Smart, who's down in about the third last row, and she fortunately had an ankle operation. And I felt really bad about that, but she was able to copy it while she had a foot up for about 6 weeks. Now, it's just fantastic timing, Judy. So congratulations again, you and your ankle. The volunteer numbers, we counted them up, was about 110 people had a part in the book. It's sort of crowd-funded history in that way, and it's just a project that probably won't happen again. So the reception of the book, we got some great publicity. Red Simons had me on. Philip Brady had me on, as he did Andrew and I the other night. And The Age gave us a 2 to 3 page spread, which was quite amazing. We had incredible sales. We sold all the books that we got out of our printer, publisher, before Christmas, and they were completely gone. And all the profits from that, so sales, went to supporting our journal, which is, as Andrew reminded us, was 105 or 6 years old at the moment. So it's probably the second oldest historical journal in the country, something we should be really proud of. I'm sad to say that I think Sydney's is the oldest. That's the way it goes. They had a head start on us. So, you know, all the money goes to supporting our publications in the society, and now we've got a second print. So your duty is to go out and buy, buy, buy. It's Father's Day coming soon. Christmas is coming up. You've got neighbours, you've got friends, everyone that you think would love this book. It's the amazing price of $35. It's just incredible. The 368 beautiful pages, and it's full of information, great images that you'll never see again of that lost world of Melbourne. So thank you so much.